the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, everybody. Greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, as Tom says. I am Danielle, here with Shano, sitting in for Tom today. Of course, we are watching the news closely on the breaking news of the airplane crash in the Alps, 150 lives presumed lost. And we will let you know if there's any updates. But there is so much to cover today that I want to jump right into it, starting with the next great Treasury raid. A tax plan that came out earlier this month that the New York Times referred to as Marco Rubio's Rainbows and Puppies tax plan. Excuse me.
I thought it was amazing. I heard nothing about this. Very little. We scour the news on a regular basis, Danielle, you know, for this show. I did not hear much at all. There's a few articles when I went looking back through it once I tracked down this tax plan. You know, the Wall Street Journal loving it, the New York Times hating it. But other than that, I mean, I guess all we had to hear about was, you know, Hillary Clinton's emails.
Right. Somehow we missed it. But Josh Mound, doctoral candidate and contributor of at Jacob Magazine, Department of History, University of Michigan, Shano, JacobinMag.com. Josh didn't miss it. In fact, he wrote an amazing piece that you could check out over at JacobinMag.com. All those links over at the website. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you call this proposal a dream that the right has had for decades, and you draw through this history so well in a way that I think Tom's listeners and viewers will appreciate, touching on things like the Powell memo and the desire to eliminate capital gains tax. How did this come about? How did you find this tax plan when seemingly we all missed it?
Well, obviously, I pay attention to what's going on with taxes. My ongoing research is basically trying to figure out the puzzle of why, if since the 1960s, most Americans have said that the rich pay too little taxes and the middle-income people pay too much in taxes, yet since the 1960s, we've really seen continual tax cuts for upper-income people and very little tax relief for middle-class people. So that puzzle of why we've basically gotten what is the opposite of what public opinion would seem to dictate is kind of what drives my research.
Now, capital gains tax, as Tom typically describes, the income that people get from sitting around a pool collecting dividends checks, and something that Republicans have been working to eliminate or lessen for decades. You write that the Treasury Department has essentially been calling these out as loopholes since as far back as the 70s. How is it that we're still debating this, that we're still considering capital gains income different from regular income and giving it a special tax break?
Well, I don't think that there's necessarily a good economic reason. For a long time, there was the argument put forth by many conservative think tanks and Republicans that cutting capital gains taxes would basically stimulate investment, drive growth, and that growth would trickle down to middle income and lower income people. But quite a few studies from the Congressional Research Service, the Congressional Budget Office, as well as academic studies have said that that's really not the case. When you cut capital gains taxes, what you tend to do is just hand income to the very rich, and you don't really get a lot in terms of economic growth for it. However, as you said, conservative think tanks have really wanted this for a long time. They've wanted not just low capital gains taxes, but no capital gains taxes. And Republicans have very, very much pushed this all the way back since, you know, after World War II. Democrats, on the other hand, with the exception of a few like George McGovern and independent now Bernie Sanders, really have been reluctant to say, you know, we should just tax capital gains at the same rates as ordinary income. So if you have two sides, one of which is pushing very strongly for low or no taxes, and the other side is relatively, you know, meek and hemming and hawing and saying, well, you know, maybe a little bit higher capital gains taxes Obama pushed for during the fiscal cliff negotiations a few years ago to increase capital gains taxes from 15% to 20%. But that's, you know, relatively small potatoes tinkering around the edges. And in fact, Democrats have actually signed capital gains tax cuts into law. Both President Carter and President Clinton signed capital gains tax cuts into law. Carter in particular did it somewhat grudgingly, but nonetheless he did it. And I think that sort of speaks to the difference in power on the right and the left when it comes to capital gains taxes in particular.
There is so much history involved in this and so many questions when I start flipping through this Rubio, Mike Lee, tax plan that we're going to get into in a second. But I want to quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with Josh Mound, doctoral candidate at the Department of History, University of Michigan, contributor to Jacobin Magazine. And Josh is willing to take your calls. If you have questions about these capital gains stories, about the next great Treasury raid, you can call in and speak to Josh. Ask him your own question. But how is it that the Republicans are still passing this off as a plan that benefits all of us? That's, you know, Marco Rubio's, as the New York Times called it, rainbows and puppies tax plan, that this is somehow going to benefit us all when really most of us wouldn't benefit from eliminating the capital gains tax.
Well, I think a big part of that is if you look at polling data about capital gains taxes, if you just ask the public, do you support a cut in the capital gains tax? You might get a majority of the people who respond either yes or no to say yes, they support a cut. But the reason that happens is that about a third of people, maybe more in most polls, actually don't answer. They don't know what capital gains income is. They don't know what the capital gains tax is. And there's a simple reason for that, which is that most people don't get capital gains income. About 90% of all capital gains income goes to the top 20% of taxpayers, and 70% goes to just the top 1%. So your average middle income person, you know, and certainly lower income person receives very, very little, if any, capital gains. In fact, really the only capital good that most people have besides maybe their 401k, which is actually taxed at regular income rates when you take that income out, would be their house. And for decades and decades, there has been a special exemption for the sale of your home that far exceeds what, you know, most average people will make in terms of a profit on their house, that essentially if you sell your house, you use that profit to buy another house, you're not subject to the capital gains tax. So for most low income, middle income people, you never think about the capital gains tax, you never pay the capital gains tax. So it's really an issue where every person pays a little bit more in taxes to make up for this loophole, to make up for the revenue loss to this loophole. And you don't really notice that you're paying, you know, a couple hundred dollars or whatever more a year than you should because of this loophole. But the upper income person who's making hundreds of thousand dollars or more certainly notice this, and they're the ones with the money to lobby to make sure that the taxes are low and, if the Rubio plan gets enacted, non-existent.
Yeah, you hit on one of my very next questions for you. Last year, this same plan, or a very similar plan, was evaluated and estimated to cost our nation, if it was enacted, about $2.4 trillion. This year, Rubio and Lee are saying it's actually going to benefit us in the long run by just shy of $100 billion. Is this solely due to the change in dynamic scoring, if you're familiar with that? Or is there some way that I'm missing that this tax cut for the rich could actually benefit us economically?
It is solely due to dynamic scoring. In fact, the first Rubio-Lee plan didn't even include this break for capital gains. So those earlier estimates actually understate most likely the benefits that will accrue to upper income taxpayers under this new plan. And basically, the Tax Foundation is the organization that produced those estimates that you're referring to that said that it would actually generate revenue in the long run. And that is what they did, is a form of dynamic scoring. The Tax Foundation is sort of a business-backed tax think tank that generally produces very favorable estimates for conservative tax plans like this. And so essentially they're projecting that, you know, we'll cut capital gains taxes, we'll have this tremendous boost of investment by upper income people, and it'll trickle down to everyone. So, I mean, it is basically the trickle-down theory that we're all sort of familiar with, and it's become sort of a caricature embodied in this estimate.
Yeah, and I think we've all heard it before. One second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Josh Mound, doctoral candidate at the University of Michigan, contributor at Jacob Magazine, taking your calls next. Stick around.
Well, they say if you protest police brutality and you don't protest police deaths, then you're a hypocrite. That's what conservatives have been saying ever since two New York City cops were murdered Saturday in an apparent revenge attack for the killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. Probably the best example of this kind of thinking comes from Mike Barnicle, who wrote in the Daily Beast today that Unlike other professions, doctor, lawyer, teacher, journalist, sales clerk, stockbroker, when a cop makes a bad mistake, it could mean someone is dead. Now, two of them are dead. Who will hit the streets to galvanize support and express rage over the execution of two young men killed because of who they were and what they did for work? Mike is really missing the point. No one disagrees about whether or not it's wrong to murder cops. Murdering cops is obviously wrong. Murdering anybody is wrong. But just because something is wrong doesn't mean it's worthy of protest. Let me explain. As Mike Barnicle himself pointed out in his piece for the Daily Beast, it's dangerous to be a police officer. And as awful as it is to say, this means that on-the-job deaths are part of the equation when it comes to working in law enforcement. And therefore, we should do everything we can to avoid them. But ultimately, they're probably going to happen, especially in a country like ours that has such lax gun laws. The murder of unarmed civilians like Michael Brown and Eric Garner, on the other hand, is not just part of the equation. It doesn't come with the job of being a young black man. Police officers are supposed to protect people, not kill them. This is why people are so upset about the Garner and Brown cases. They're angry because those cases show how badly this system is broken. And that's a really important point. People don't protest when tragic things happen to people who willingly put themselves in harm's way. A fireman gets killed in a fire. You don't protest it. You feel sorry for them. You know, help the family however you can. But people protest when they don't think the system is working the way it should. So no, the protesters who took to the streets after Eric Garner's escaped a murder charge are not hypocrites if they don't protest the deaths of two New York City police officers. They're just doing what normal people do when they see injustice in their world. But the idea that people should protest the murder of police officers and that they apparently shouldn't protest police brutality, that's just the latest sign of a dangerous trend in American society. And that trend is the knee-jerk worship of authority figures like police officers and the military. At some point in our recent history, I would argue it was right after 9/11, we as Americans decided that we weren't going to have a thoughtful conversation about the proper role of law enforcement and other authority figures in our society. Instead, we decided that we were going to label all police officers and the military as heroes and then ask questions later. Never mind the fact that it's actually far more dangerous to be a logger or a fisherman than it is to be a cop. If someone wore a badge, we made them into gods in uniform. Make no mistake, there's a direct line leading from our hero worship of gods to the arming of local police forces with weapons of war, and then to the killing of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. We basically told police officers they were beyond the law, and they've acted accordingly. There's a very real problem in this country right now with police violence and police brutality. But we'll never fix that problem if we continue to talk about cops as if they're always heroes and not public servants. And let's be honest. When conservatives say that people angry about police brutality should be protesting the murder of police officers, they're not actually trying to raise awareness about how dangerous it is to be a cop. They're trying to shut down debate about the proper role of police in our society. And that's a debate we need to have. And it starts with one thing. Recognizing that the police are hired to serve us and not the other way around.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program.
My computer's being a real pain today.
Computer is...
I'm going to restart it, actually.
Yes. I'm Danielle here with Shano, sitting in for Tom today, and we are still speaking with Josh Mound, doctoral candidate at the Department of History of the University of Michigan and contributor to Jacobin magazine. Thank you, Shano. Josh, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Sorry about the mispronunciation there earlier. You ready to take some calls?
Sure.
Great. Lots of people want your expert opinion. So let's start with Shirley watching on Dish Network in Wheeling, West Virginia. Shirley, you have a question for Josh.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to ask Josh a question about taxes. Since we need to raise money, I'm questioning why the churches are able to be tax exempt when they are totally businesses these days. I think they should only be allowed to be exempt for money they contribute to charity, because just showing Ted Cruz yesterday announcing his presidential run at a college that I'm sure gets government funds and also is tax exempt, just seemed outrageous to me. I don't see how that would possibly be okay to do that, and that they forcibly made the kids go.
Yes. Okay, Shirley, let's let Josh respond. Josh, any thoughts on the church tax exemption?
I think that's a good point, and I'm sure a lot of people agree with that. It's been a controversial proposal for a long time. Even someone like George Wallace, when he ran for president, actually talked about eliminating tax exemptions for foundations and churches and things like that. But it's hard, obviously, to make that case when churches are seen as sort of, you know, as American as apple pie, that I don't think there's maybe a good economic reason or a good reason of fairness to exempt churches. But when you have that sort of image of churches, it's very hard to get rid of their tax exemption. I do wonder, as, you know, the population becomes more secular, church attendance, you know, has been going down, are more people going to be willing to say, you know, we don't want our tax dollars to be subsidizing churches? I wouldn't be surprised if someday that happens, but I doubt that we're going to see anyone in the Republican Party, certainly, and probably not the Democratic Party, who are going to be willing to propose today that we should stop giving churches tax exemptions, even if it might be a good idea.
Excellent point. Let's check in with Caroline, listening in Lynn Haven, Florida. Caroline, you are a small investor, you say.
That's correct. I am a small investor. I'm 72, single gal. So capital gains helps me. So my question to Mr. Mound is, how does one get rich or comfortable where you're not a burden to society, if not for investments such as capital gains and other investments? And thank you. And one more suggestion.
Okay.
The lady that just called, I agree with her about these churches. I'm an atheist, so I shouldn't have to support them. And I would love for y'all to have David Silverman, who is the head of the American Atheist Society.
I believe he has been on with Tom, Carolyn, but let's let Josh answer your question about capital gains first.
Well, first of all, if you tax capital gains at the same rates as ordinary income, we would still have graduated rates. So smaller investors would obviously still be paying tax rates that were lower than, you know, Warren Buffett or very, very rich investors. So I don't think if you transition to a system where you had capital gains tax at the same rates as earned income, as labor income, it would necessarily burden small investors any more than they are now. And another important thing to remember is that the way that most Americans, insofar as they do have their own investments, they invest in their employer's 401k or a Roth IRA or something like that, and those are completely outside of the capital gain system. So, for example, 401ks, when you take money out, you're actually paying the rate that is the ordinary income rate, not the special capital gains rate. So, I mean, you could actually even argue that in that way, you know, the investment income system is sort of doubly stacked against middle income people right now, because their investments are most likely to be in a 401k. And then when they take it out, when they're retired, they're actually paying the ordinary income tax rates anyhow, not the low rates that the Warren Buffetts are paying.
This, in my opinion, is kind of one of those ways they dupe us average Joe type people into believing that issues like lowering the capital gains tax affect us all, as you touch on so well in your article. I want to remind everybody that they can go and check out the next great Treasury raid over at Jacobin Magazine. Am I right on that? Is that a fair assumption?
I think it is a fair assumption. And I mean, I think that gets back to, you know, the polling data that I mentioned earlier, that just, you know, a third of people don't really have any strong opinion about capital gains, most likely because they don't really experience capital gains tax rates. So it becomes a really sort of esoteric problem that is a policy that most people don't think about. And, you know, the people who do think about it a lot are the very, very, you know, rich investors for whom this means, you know, huge, huge amounts of money each year. And so they're the ones who are lobbying to keep the rates low, where most Americans might not really think about capital gains tax rates. But, you know, when a poll actually explains to Americans, here's what capital gains tax rates are, they're actually lower. You know, if Bob makes $50,000 a year from an investment, he pays this preferential rate. If, you know, Bill makes $50,000 a year as a, you know, firefighter or, you know, working at a bookstore or whatever, and he pays this higher rate, then most people in polls say, wow, that's really unfair, we should get rid of that.
Well, it's all about the message, as always. I think we have time really quickly for one really fast question. Let's go with Anita in San Antonio, Texas, watching on DirecTV. Anita, can you get a real quick question in for Josh?
I'll try. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
Do you know of any empirical evidence that trickle-down or supply-side economics has actually worked or benefited the middle class and other people, the poor? And or do you know of any place in the world where this has worked, this type of economics has worked?
Well, conservative think tanks obviously, you know, try to manufacture evidence that says that it's worked. But more objective studies by the Congressional Budget Office or the Congressional Research Service has really called into question whether that happens. And if you just were to take even, you know, a really simple graph looking at average capital gains tax rates and growth, there's no correlation.
Something we'll have to keep searching for. Josh, thank you so much for all of your brilliant responses.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Josh Mound, Jacobin Magazine. The article is fascinating. Go check it out, and we'll be back with more of your calls right after this. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle here with Shano sitting in for Tom today. If you're in L.A. this weekend, check Tom out at Sister Giant 3. You can find out all the information at sistergiant.com or, of course, tomhartman.com. And big thanks to Josh Mound of Jacobin Magazine.
Smart
brilliant,
yeah.
Brilliant guest.
That's what happens at the University of Michigan, I'm telling you.
I was waiting for the reference. I was waiting for Hail to the Victors to start playing from Shane's computer over there.
He was a serious academic there and great on the radio, too,
yeah.
And television.
Absolutely.
I would love to spend a couple hours picking his brain, quite honestly. So it's always nice to have someone in the academic sphere who is working on this currently who actually reinforces the things that we talk about here on a regular basis, what Tom talks about, you know, in terms of, you know, trickle-down hasn't worked, is not going to work. All the evidence shows that it doesn't work and that it's just essentially a conspiracy of the rich.
Yeah. I mean, he goes through the history of, you know, how capital gains became
a thing
and how individuals like you and I got caught up in supporting them. And it goes back to California, Prop 13, which lowered capital gains rates on home sales.
Right.
And then, as Tom said, it all started with Reagan.
Right.
During the Reagan campaign, he started campaigning that the Steiger Act, I don't know if it's Steiger, S-T-E-I, Steiger Act, was pretty much the same thing as Prop 13.
Because it had to deal with capital gains.
Right. Conflated investment income with home sales and duped us all into thinking that capital gains were a good thing.
Right. And by the way, like Josh said, if you sell a home and you buy another one, you're not going to have the capital gains. Also, there's a one-time exemption for home sales of someone, I think, over the age of 60 or 65. So most people don't ever realize a capital gain on their home sale, or they have to pay it because there's the exemption, it's graduated, and there's a one-time exemption, I believe. It's a lot of one of those reverse mortgages that are actually based on. When Fred Thompson says it's based on laws enacted by Ronald Reagan, that's what he's referring to.
Yeah. I think a lot of Tom's audience wouldn't think of that as a positive note.
No.
Yeah.
I'll stay away from that. Thank you.
And a special shout out to the Congressional Progressive Caucus, because one of the platforms in their budget that they've put forward is to equalize tax rates for investment income and income for work, saying that the dog catcher, the surgeon, all of the above should not have a higher tax rate than somebody who sits around a pool collecting dividend checks.
And while the bulk of the Democratic Party doesn't have that in there, the progressives do. And also, if you look at Tom's book, Rebooting the American Dream, on page 50, if we want to keep the stock options as compensation, we must at least tax those stock options at the same top marginal tax rates as the salaries of the rich by considering capital gains as ordinary income. Tom Hartman.
Yeah. But
if it's out there.
If it's up to Republicans, specifically Marco Rubio, or as Shane and I call him, Marco MeTubio, and Mike Lee, they would not only eliminate the capital gains tax, put it down to zero, make it no tax on income from corporate investors.
They phrase it so interestingly. Yes. They don't say that we're going to set capital gains at zero. They say that capital gains is a double taxation, and we're just going to get rid of the double taxation.
Right.
They don't even come out and say it. It has to be deciphered.
Right. But in the same tax plan, they'd like to remove the standard deduction that most people use.
Right.
Only include a personal exemption, a personal credit of $2,000 for individuals and $4,000 for families. They do include, I'll give them credit, a new child tax credit of
$2,500. But then you're going to get state
tax. But then you're going to get state tax. And I can tell you that Shane and I did, you know, our taxes, you know, quick estimate to see what the change would be.
Right. We did we've already completed our taxes for this year, you know, that they get filed in a couple weeks or whatever. So I pulled out those forms. And since we just use a basic form, I really quickly did the calculations using their plan, using their rate and their exemption model or whatever. Pretty easy to do. I think I had $26 less in federal taxes, and you had around $50 less, and that's over an entire year.
Yeah, I think about 30.
Yeah.
However, if we were multimillionaires,
it would be, it's one of those curves. If you watch the curve, for most people it's like this, and zoom, right up if you make a ton of money, because they want to have two, you know, lower tax breaks, brackets, and then business taxes, they want to go from 35 to 25. This is all the things we've heard before.
Right.
But now that they have control of both houses, if they can get past the filibuster on the budget in the Senate, then they can just use reconciliation to enact this. This is very close to being a possibility, and they can taste it.
Right.
A President Ted Cruz, we would have this plan. We would have this scheme under his regime. I mean, it would be devastating.
This is a drop in the bucket compared to the Republican budget that came out yesterday. You said we'll get to that later in the show. They essentially don't want to just eliminate the capital gains tax. Yeah, they want to eliminate everything, eliminate government in general.
Right.
But this whole capital gains discussion brings up the discussion of whether work and income should be tied. Whether wealth and work should be tied together.
Yeah,
should you have to work to make an income? Because the Republicans now make it clear that you shouldn't have to.
Well, they want to have investment income, which there's not work involved. There's a decision involved, yes, but there's not work involved. When I mean work, I mean physical work. Pounds lifted, brain power used, something created, something built, something torn down. You know, if you're a demolitionist or whatever, work actually done. They want to have it be tax-free and just the money roll in for doing next to nothing.
Right.
So that made me think, and actually Jan Freel brought this up, and it kind of blew my mind when he just kind of...
Of alternate.
Yeah, of alternate. Yeah. He said, why is it we have a system where work is tied to income? Why is work tied to income or wealth? Right now we have a Republican Party that wants to decouple health insurance from working. So why don't we disentangle income from working, and we would end up with a system. And this is essentially the basic minimum income.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about here. That it would bring about a much better allocation of human resources, if you want to use that phrase. I know a lot of people don't like it, but the work that people do could be done more efficiently in things that they're interested in, would be more productive, would be across the board. It would just reallocate all of that, and we could actually move towards a less scarcity-based society where essentially you're constantly fighting. You're constantly fighting the economic system to get just enough to survive instead of having, here's enough to survive. Now go do what you're great at, you know, and society will benefit as a whole.
Right.
I was wondering what people thought of that.
Right, because, you know, we're presented with the plan of minimal taxes. Minimal taxes on investment income. I think the inverse, the alternative plan, would be minimum scarcity, minimum suffering that progressives would want, and would a basic minimum income be a way to achieve that goal or not? We'd love to hear people's opinion.
And I'm not saying that everyone should get equal everything in the world, but equitable. And I really believe that although Republicans talk on and on and on about providing opportunity, giving people the opportunity to succeed, their system is actually based on denying opportunity to certain people. I really do. Because otherwise, in their system, if everyone had the opportunity to be mega wealthy, who would mow their lawns or clean their homes or change their baby's diapers, et cetera? They have a vested interest in actually denying opportunity because they really believe in their hearts that, one, people are generally not real great leaders. They're generally bad and generally lazy. They really believe that if people got a basic minimum income, they just wouldn't do anything. I can't imagine that. Most people want to do something and be productive. They take pride in that. That's what they do, especially if it's something they're passionate about.
Yeah. I think that people would actually continue to work or work in a different way if they had that opportunity. So instead of costing $2.5 trillion to give rich folks another tax break,
right,
you know, why shouldn't we spend that money on giving people a minimum income so that they can focus on the areas, the expertise, the creativity.
And as technology develops,
they really enjoy.
Scarcity will decrease. It should. I mean, they were talking about this in the 1950s, about the leisure society.
Right.
It was never, it never happened because we had then, fiscal policies that are put into place that scraped all the wealth out for very few people. You know, but this could be a way of not making things equal, but equitable.
Yeah. So we'd love to hear your thoughts. Of course, Ted Cruz is still on the table if
sure.
you want to talk about him. We talked about him so much yesterday. We're trying to give you guys a break. We like to say that it's anything goes when Tom's not here.
Indeed.
Yes. Do we have time for one call?
For one call.
Okay. Let's jump in. Tim, listening on iTunes in Cupertino, California. Tim, thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, there's a pretty simple solution with capital gains, which would be pick a number, $50,000 a year, and say anything below that, you would pay capital gains tax. Anything more than that would be considered income. You could also do the same thing for age. So if you were over 65 and capital gains was your retirement income, you could allow people to have more capital gains income, you know, for their retirement. But what you would do is you would stop people who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year or millions of dollars a year and paying less than the people who are working.
Yeah, so right. A progressive income tax on capital gains, just maybe a different scale.
That's actually what they're doing now. Because if they actually cared about of the small investor, that's the system they would set up. Republicans say they care about the small investor. They don't. They care about the big investor. And that's just what it comes down to. They're lying.
Yeah.
They're lying.
Tim, I don't have a problem with that plan personally.
Yeah.
I think if it encourages real innovation, not billionaire corporations saying they're innovating, I would be all for it, especially if the little guy gets a break instead of the billionaires. But thank you for listening, and thank you for adding your thoughts there from California. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What would you do if you were given a basic minimum income? How would you spend your time? Welcome back. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV and the Tom Hartman program. Let's check in with Johnny in Lamarck, Texas, watching on DirecTV. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Johnny.
In the words of Hollywood actor / authority figure wannabe Fred Thompson, hello, folks. That's what comes to my mind every time MSNBC plays that stupid advertisement for reverse mortgages. Is he comes on and says, right, Jesse? But the first thing I see in my head is, hello, folks. Because that's all he's got.
I have to say, I have to credit Stephanie Miller anytime Fred Thompson comes on, because I consistently think about the jokes she made when he was running and that he's pretty tired and he needs to go home now.
Yeah, and he didn't have any gas then. He didn't have any gas to be selling people the scam on reverse mortgage. And by the way, I didn't call about basic minimum income or BMI, but I would suggest one thing for that.
Okay.
Find another name. Don't call it basic minimum income, because Rush Limbaugh, the first thing he's going to do, he's going to make derogatory statements about people getting fat and lazy, and their BMI is going to go up.
Well, pot kettle for him online, too. But besides people who aren't here to respond to those arguments, do you have a thought on the economic situation on the Rubio tax plan?
What tax plan? I was originally inspired to call because of your guest, Josh Mound, and he's gone, but let me say this much, and now I'm having a brain fart. Thank you very much.
Well, we can get back.
Yeah, Johnny, we'll give us a call again so we can get to another call, but you know, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the economic plan, on the so-called tax plan. Let's check in with Greg in Carrollton, Virginia, watching on DirecTV. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Greg.
Hey, good afternoon. You're calling from California, kind of stole some of my thunder, but the $50,000 annually being exempt from taxes on capital gains and dividends would go a long way to ensuring that working class citizens are encouraged to invest, and they could actually be able to take that money out if a life event dictated it, such as taking care of an elder parent or, God forbid, a child gets sick or something like that. Additionally, when you consider that the median income in the country is about $53,000 and many citizens don't have a defined pension plan any longer, you'd actually be giving them about $62,000 a year in income, which would help them with dealing with medical issues or prescription drugs and issues like that.
Yeah, any progressive tax plan, I would have to say that I'm in favor of. I don't know that most people are really making about $50,000.
Right.
The
I'm
trouble with
it.
Averages.
I'm not against it.
Yeah.
I found it interesting. I didn't know this when Josh mentioned 401ks. I knew they were taxed when you withdrew the money, but I didn't know it was taxed as ordinary income. So when the whole scam, well, if you have money on 401k, capital gains affects you. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. It's only what a 401k, I guess. I always knew it was deferred tax, but I thought it was capital gains at the end. It's ordinary income at the end. So, you know, in this situation he's talking about is if you pull money out of a 401k for one of those emergencies, you're going to get taxed on it. You're actually going to get taxed plus a penalty. So to have that benefit is a good idea.
Well, and Greg, thank you very much for the call and for watching there on Free Speech TV. I think Greg also hits on a very important point in that encouraging Americans to save. You know, most of us don't have enough money to hold us over in the event in an emergency. So if there was a way to do that, I think that would be a good thing. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, here with Shano sitting in for Tom today, taking your calls on capital gains, minimum income.
Any supply-siders on the board?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure, but let's check in with Brent in Columbus, Ohio. Brent, thanks for listening to Sirius. You had a question?
No, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to comment. We always talk about income tax, but the truth is, income tax is not where the wealthy get their money. We're never going to actually tax the wealthy if we raise income tax. And the truth is, I don't know why we're not asking, do we still need an income tax? Companies just got done reporting their quarterlies, and for 2014, every company with a market share of more than $1 billion together that publicly traded had $8.7 trillion of profit. $8.7 trillion of profit. If we abolished the income tax and taxed every company that had a market share of $1 billion or more that was publicly traded alone at a flat 35%, we would get about $3 trillion, which is more than what the government gets right now with our income tax and our corporate taxes. And again,
but Brent, I don't disagree with you. I think you're right on the money. You know, if you look at conservatives often talk about what share of income tax revenue that the rich pay. But if you look at what share corporations used to pay versus what they pay now and the difference in how much more is sitting on the shoulders of the middle class, regardless of whether or not you agree or disagree on a individual income tax, if corporations were just paying what they used to pay, we would be fine. We would have plenty of money to deal with social programs, to deal with our infrastructure, et cetera. But they're not. They've shifted the burden onto you and I.
So steal the Republicans' thunder by advocating a plan that literally abolishes all income tax and shifts the burden of the economy onto those who benefit the most by it by abolishing the income tax.
Well,
and essentially removing a racist income tax policy, which disproportionately taxes minorities in the same tax bracket as white people.
Yeah, there are a lot of problems with the current system. I would not, for one, advocate eliminating the income tax, but it's certainly an idea. It's, you know, we're not going to get to a solution without playing with ideas like this. And Brent, Who knows?
Politically, though, I think his what he's trying to say here.
It would have a lot of weight.
That would hit like a political, you know, firestorm.
Right.
Really? You're going to get rid of all? I mean, it would be interesting to sell.
It would be hard for Republicans to fight it, Brent. I don't know how they'd come up with a message against that plan. We'll have to give it some thought. But thank you for listening on Sirius there in Ohio. Let's check in with Russell, listening on WCPT in Hickory Hills, Illinois.
Yes. You know, I'm surprised nobody's brought up Scott Walker and his ban of nutcases in Wisconsin. I don't know if you heard this. He's got a proposal, and it's in the House now, passing. No more weekends. Your company has the right to make you work 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Have you heard that?
Yes.
I have heard that. And, Russell, I'm just curious if you think there's any correlation there between that and the conservative budget that just came out that, among other things, wants to eliminate the National Labor Relations Board, the very board that would stand up for us when it comes to...
This is the conservative budget, not the GOP budget.
You know what? It gets there. I want to see them pass that in Alabama on Sunday when these people go to church.
They might get a different response, Russell. I think you are on to something. Excellent point.
I guess the rule is up there that your employer can ask you to work 7 days a week, but you don't have to. So you have to agree to it. But essentially, people come out and say, well, essentially, an employer can put a gun to your head because it's right to work. You know. So you'll end up having to work 7 days a week, and I guess there's no overtime for this or whatever?
I will admit I have not read the plan. I've seen the headlines about it. I know exactly what he is talking about, but I have not read the details. Maybe somebody listening
just goes on and on.
Yeah, maybe somebody listening who has some details about that can call in and fill us in. Some on-the-ground citizen reporting.
There we go.
I'm sure there's lots of brilliant folks who would like to share the details of that. Do we have time for another call?
Yes.
All right. Let's check in with Michael listening on TuneIn in Greenville, South Carolina. Thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program, Michael.
Yes. I have a couple of comments, I guess, about BMI.
Minimum income?
Yeah, the minimum income. It strikes me when I was studying economic theory in high school, the only thing that I remember is the old saying, each according to their own needs, by Karl Marx. And this strikes me as very much similar to that.
Well, if you went back and read Thomas Jefferson's Agrarian Justice, which I wouldn't really consider him a Marxist.
I think it'd be an interesting experiment, and I'm not against it, and I'm not calling it communism. I'm just struck that the idea in its infancy.
Yeah, there actually have been experiments, Michael. I believe it was in Canada that Tom talked about a little while ago.
And there's an ongoing one in Alaska.
Right, good point. That actually gave each citizen a basic minimum income, and there's some really interesting information about what the results were and how that town reacted, how people...
It's Thomas Paine.
Thomas Paine.
I said Jefferson. Agrarian justice.
Yeah.
I was wrong.
Michael, hey, I don't know. I think sometimes there's confusion between equality and saying that everybody should get some equal stipend of the exact same amount and equity, people don't need to suffer as much as they do in the richest country on the planet. But
I agree there. I think this would be an interesting experiment. I mean, you know, to decouple work from taxation or income.
Yeah, and there would still be plenty of room for people to get rich and invent things and innovate. And I think we'd get a lot more interesting creativity and exciting inventions if people weren't having to work three jobs to put food on the table.
Or on their family.
Yeah, on their family.
To put food on your table.
Thank you, George Bush. Thank you, Michael, for listening there in Greenville, South Carolina. We will be back with more. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, here with Shano in for Tom today. If you are in L.A. this weekend, or if you'll be near a computer, check out Sister Giant, sistergiant.com. Tom will be speaking with Dennis Kucinich and Senator Bernie Sanders. All the information, of course, over at TomHartman.com. And we still have lots of great stuff to talk about today. People want to weigh in on taxes, on basic minimum income, and we will get to all of that. But I do have an official transcript of Ted Cruz's presidential announcement I just wanted to mention really quickly.
This is courtesy of DU.
Courtesy of Democratic Underground. I do not like the neutral net. I do not like the migrant threat. I do not like when two men kiss. I do not like the atheists. I don't believe in climate change, nor in state health care exchanges. I do not like to feed the poor, but I would like to start a war, and I support the 1% and shutting down the government. You do not like me, so you say. Try me, and you may. I'm asking for your vote today to bring about the end times. Yay.
I love that.
Brilliant folks over there. I wish I thought of that. Brilliant, brilliant.
I'm glad they did.
Yes, they did a great job, and you can check that out over at democraticunderground.com. In just a bit. A little later this hour, we're going to speak with Kimmon Freeman, who is a personal friend as well as an award-winning activist, playwright, and co-owner of We Act Radio here in Washington, D.C. And he's going to be talking about his one-man show, Angry Black Man in Therapy, ABMIT. And it got me thinking about that phrase, Angry Black Man, and about a lot of the stuff that we were just talking about, economic injustice, the fact that minorities still struggle today to reach the same points socially, economically, politically, education-wise as whites. And it made me think that, you know what? There's probably a lot for minorities to be angry about. I was reading a piece by Lynn Stewart Paramore, A Bad Economy Fuels Racism. Brilliant work. We may or may not be talking to her later in the week. I know Sean is working on that. But and it goes into how these economic decisions, how decisions just like Marco Rubio and Mike Lee's economic plan to benefit the rich, how that actually affects our social system, how it affects people's views on minorities and on views of people of different ethnic backgrounds. And she actually talks about a New York University psychology professor, David Amodio, who set out to study whether economic hardship affects how we perceive race, how we actually view people of different ethnic backgrounds. And what they found is that when people think about economic scarcity, just what Shane was talking about earlier, about not having enough to go around, they're actually more likely to see African-American faces as darker and more stereotypically black, and that subconscious bias heightens discrimination, and that this is a pervasive problem that affects our economic system, certainly our criminal justice system. It affects things like, You know, home buying, self-segregation, education systems.
It affects our political system.
Look our at the, political
look
system.
Look at the debate we're having over immigration.
Right. And it ties into a really troubling report by the National Urban League that created something called the Equality Index. Basically, they take a cross-section of various statistics, various data inputs from the Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the CDC, crime data, et cetera. They put all of these together and create the Equality Index. And they found that for 2015, Black Americans are 72.2% as equal as white Americans. That still today in 2015, where we're seeing this unraveling of the civil rights work that was done decades ago, we're seeing the Voting Rights Act be destroyed. We're having disparate impact up being questioned in the Supreme Court. Maybe we'll get into that later this week, Shano.
Yeah,
that,
idea.
That's a really interesting topic. But still in this day and age where we hear comments like, you know, the civil rights fight is over and racism doesn't exist, it's not a problem anymore, we see that blacks experience less than 3/4 of the quality of life that white Americans experience. And it just rolls back into say, well, yeah, if I was getting 3/4 of the fairness of somebody else, why wouldn't I be angry?
And that's actually an oxymoron to say someone gets 3/4 of the fairness or 3/4 of the equality. 100% of equality would be equal.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's less equal.
It
period.
Is. But it shows
we're not
how
equal. I'm messing my own self up there.
It shows how it's all tied together and how just what Lynn was trying to point out, who writes for Alternate, this piece specifically is up over at Al Jazeera, that racial tension and economic hardship feed off each other. And so when we have people in control of our country who are working for the 1%, it tends to recreate the same social dynamic that we saw leading up to the Civil Rights Act, where minorities in this country are treated as less than equal, less than human. And so, heck yeah, they're angry.
Well, also, economic disparity creates distrust.
Tom's
talked about this often, both for the people who have a lot because they think everyone's trying to get it, and those who don't, who think that those who have it are to blame. And that's why they often play, well, you're playing class politics, and it's just the what was one of the terms? I can't remember the phrase now, but they use all those phrases. But when you don't trust other people, you tend to go back to the clan mentality. I mean that with a C, of course, or family or tribe mentality. And some of the ways that our psychology is set up, unfortunately, whether it's, you know, by the way we've been brought up or by the way we are wired, is to other people.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be on race, but that's a fallback. That's a simple one. That's one that has been around in this country since its inception.
Right. You see how that's affected even our perception of the phrase angry black man, where why shouldn't they have a right to be angry? If you said I'm an angry white woman, nobody would bat an eyelash. But there's a lot for people who aren't in the 1% to be angry about. But we have turned that phrase into the other. We've made it a negative, a stereotype, said that there's something wrong with a minority being angry.
Well, and also can stoke
I think
fear
that,
among
yeah,
bigots.
That, exactly.
Well, see, and you have to be scared of the angry black man. Do you
right.
not? You know, the back to the, you know, the thugs rioting, you know, they use those terms, you know, all the pejorative terms. That's just a pejorative phrase.
Right.
And it does come from economic roots.
It's just I would love to hear other people's opinions on this, maybe stories about how your economic situation throughout your life maybe changed your social views, maybe changed your perception on living in a different community. You know, maybe you grew up in an all white community and all of a sudden you find yourself somewhere else. How your economic situation affected that view personally. I think we could learn something about each other and about ourselves by having that discussion.
Sure.
And I don't think that we're really going to get into solutions until we have those type of discussions.
Right. And as these bad economics hit more and more white people, you'll notice there'll be more and more people in the street.
Yes.
Because now all of a sudden, there's a large portion of the white population who are now being treated in some ways, not in all ways, like the African Americans have been treated forever. And they're saying, this sucks. We're going to join up and join forces, which I think is the right thing to do.
Well, and that's some people think that now this is a class situation based primarily on economic status. What do you think?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't you think minorities and black men have a right to be angry? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program on Free Speech TV. I wanted to check in with you guys. Let's jump to Jesse, listening or watching on Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. Jesse, thanks for hanging out with us here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Danielle, and your partner.
Shano.
Hey, your subject is right on. Being black, African-American, hey, I told Tom a couple of weeks ago, being white privilege is just the flip side. You imagine where this country would be at if there wasn't no people of color being here?
I don't think anybody can imagine, because people of color, immigrants and minorities built this country literally with their bare hands in many instances.
Well, just like the poor whites built England. So,
yeah,
you know,
excellent point.
That's the way it goes. But we all, as the 99% is learning how we all in this boat together. You was talking about the basic income minimum. I think the best way to get there, especially with the 1% using Hitler's fifth column and now democracy, I think the best way to get there is if Mr. Ralph Nader, some other high profile, Bernie, Miss Elizabeth Warren, say, hey, call town hall meetings and just say, let's start a public bank credit union. Everybody put their $2 in, refinance their cars, homes through this credit public bank. And I think we could be in business to do what we want, cure cancer, end poverty. What you think? If Michael Moore, all the high-profile progressives appoint Richard Wolff, some top economist as a board to make up some rules we all vote on as the guidelines for the credit union or public bank. And we could go from there. I think we can try to save this planet, keep the dirty oil in the ground.
I'm certainly in favor, Jesse, of electing Richard Wolff for anything having to do with our economy, just personally. And I do think, I honestly believe that if people weren't strapped into trivial, meaningless jobs that they needed just to put a roof over their head, just to put food on the table, that we could solve problems like cancer, like, like the environment crisis, like finding new sources of energy. I think we could solve all of that. There are so many great minds out there that are trapped working three jobs, and they don't have time to think, let alone to ponder great ideas like that.
There's a lot of lost potential out there.
The most important thing that people need to realize, and you don't hear nothing from none of the progressives saying, the system you talk about capital gains. The capitalism is eternal growth, and it's impossible. We only got one planet. We're gonna have to learn how to share.
Yeah.
And if people think we could keep growing, getting in the quarterly profit, Mother Earth ain't gonna support it.
Well, perhaps.
Am I right?
Perhaps that's a conversation we need to have. Jesse, you nailed a lot of great points in there. Thank you very much for watching there on Free Speech TV. I think we do need to learn to share. I think we need to share on a lot of issues, financially, socially. The pie can get bigger. We don't have to worry about all getting our...
The pie can get higher, too.
Yes.
I'm just going to quote George Bush.
You're going to quote George Bush? Let's see who's paying attention.
Let's make the pie higher.
Yes. The pie can get bigger. We can do better for each and every one of us. But we are going to need some great minds to think of ways to do it. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle here with Shano, sitting in for Tom today, taking your calls about lots of great topics. Tom has the smartest listeners, watchers, viewers in the world.
Indeed.
You guys are awesome. Let's check in with Greg, listening on Sirius in Jackson Springs, North Carolina. You had some thoughts on taxes.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I think everything that you're talking about really can be simplified by making those that are less fortunate pay higher taxes.
Those who are less fortunate pay higher taxes?
Yes, and the way to do that, and by the way, if we did this, we could help to get rid of, we could make our government smaller by not
so,
having...
So, Greg, just so I'm sure that I understand you, you think that our problem is that those who are least fortunate aren't paying enough?
Well, yes, and I'll tell you the way to solve this is to pay them more.
Okay.
I see what you're saying. I completely misunderstood your comment there.
Follow through the whole logic of it. The well-to-do in this country are against unions, against paying people more money, while at the same time, they're against paying more taxes. You can't have it both ways. When you have it both ways, you have the system in which we have, which they complain about.
Yeah, I think those are all excellent points. If you want more revenue and taxes, pay people more money.
Exactly. You can't expect somebody that makes $10 an hour to pay taxes.
Right.
You just can't do it because it takes more than that to live.
Right. And a lot of conservatives, Greg, would argue I think erroneously so, that people who make that much don't pay taxes, but they do. They pay sales taxes. They pay taxes on car purchases. They pay taxes on homes if they own a home, or rental taxes in some areas. You know, there are lots of ways that people pay taxes, even if they're not in a federal income tax bracket.
I think we should take the approach and really put those people on the spot. Yes, I agree with you. They should pay income tax. And the way to get them to pay income tax is to pay them more.
Well, Greg, I think that's an excellent way to respond to their arguments.
That's why people who are for increasing the minimum wage say it's going to have a net benefits. One, more demand because people have more money to spend. But two, you'll get less people in the social safety net. And three, there's more federal receipts to pay for the government services. It makes complete economic sense. From our side.
From our side. But excellent points, Greg. Yeah, excellent points. Thank you very much for listening there in North Carolina. I want to jump to Jeremy watching on YouTube in Glassboro, New Jersey. You had some thoughts on a basic income.
Yes. In my opinion, I don't think that labor should be tied to income. There are so many people in the world, in America especially, who do a job to pay the bills and pay for the utilities they need so they can go to sleep and wake up and do the job to pay the bills. And there's a way to end the cycle, which is just to give people money to survive, and then they can do the job they need. I'm a college student. I'm about to enter the market in the relatively near future. I have cerebral palsy. There are some jobs that I think I will not be able to do. Some employers may not be receptive. And, you know, we live in a world where 85 people have more wealth than literally half the planet.
I know.
And there's a... And if we just give people enough to live, the conservatives might say, oh, people will be lazy, people won't want to work. If they really think that, then it'd be proving that they're the people they despise, the lazy losers. But they're not going to do that. They're going to say, oh, no, it's not me who's lazy. It's those other people who are lazy. And they probably mean Blacks, Hispanics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I certainly think they do. Jeremy, all excellent points. And a perfect example of a college student, cerebral palsy, someone who wants to and is able to contribute to our society in many ways, that I don't think you should be burdened, you know, with having to fit in a specific mold and having to spend your entire life worrying about paying your bills.
He brings up another interesting question. I'd love to ask a conservative if they called in. What is the benefit of having half the world's wealth in 85 people's hands? How does that benefit the world? Does it? And how? How do you justify it?
Yeah.
What good does it do?
It's certainly... Because
I don't think it's defensible.
That's a big question. A very big question.
And if they want to propel that, then why do you want to propel that?
Yeah.
If there is no benefit to it, why are we doing more of it? Just for the conservatives out there, maybe there is an answer that I'm not thinking of.
I certainly don't know what the benefit could possibly be.
Right.
Not even for those 85 people, because at what point, you know, how do you spend that much money? How is it that you possibly live so well that you need that much money? I mean, you could be just disgustingly rich and not be anywhere near that.
Right. Yeah. As Tom often talks about, no billionaires, that once you get to that $1 billion, that's it.
Yeah.
You'll be just fine. We only have about a half a minute.
Okay. Well, I just want to thank Jeremy very much for watching there on YouTube in New Jersey. Thank you very much for giving your opinion. I think it's very important to hear from folks just like Jeremy. There are so many ways people can contribute. Could you imagine the problems we could solve with so many minds spent on issues instead of being wasted in a meaningless job? You know, and I think people would still do those jobs. Believe it or not, there are some people who like working in fast food. There are some people who like cleaning houses. There are some people who like all of those tasks. And there's enough work for everybody. There's enough money for everybody for a basic minimum income too. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Up next, we're going to speak with Kimon Freeman of Angry Black Man in Therapy. Stick around. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, here with Shano, sitting in for Tom today. We are just waiting on our guest, Kimon Freeman. So in the meantime, I say we'll jump to a few more of your calls. I wanted to check in with Richard in Hollywood, Florida, my hometown, actually, listening on Sirius Radio. Richard, thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I tell you, I'm an angry black man. Let me tell you why. Because there's not enough shows or there's not enough exposure for black people in the black community of shows like this. It's amazing, and I live in the black community, and when it comes to conservatives, most blacks believe that conservatives are racist in the black community. Not all, but most. And the reason they believe that, because of some of the things that they see on television, whether it's Fox News or some of that other stuff that we see on television. I'm an advocate, and it may sound funny, but I'm an advocate to people, especially black people, to know that every white person is not the same. But I must tell you, conservatives really give white people a bad name.
I know, and we're painting with a broad brush with comments like that, Richard, but it just came out this week that the Republican Party is 95% white. 95%. That is astonishing, and it makes it kind of easy to understand why we get to broad brush conclusions like you're mentioning.
I mean, I had a black young man, a friend of mine. He was talking to me, and he watched Fox News. He watched a lot of different shows. He watched Fox News, and he told me, he said, it seemed as if that conservatives actually believe that black people are just almost ignorant. Some of the things that you see on Fox News and some of the things that they say, but they continue to say it's not racist to say some of the things that they say. But in the black community, they're looking at it and saying, so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, I love Tom Hartman. I love this show. And I'm always telling my friends to please listen, because we need to hear this. We need to hear that we're not in this all by itself. And so I just wanted to tell you guys, I really commend you and just love what you're doing. I can't wait to hear the author coming up for that book.
Yeah, it's actually a show, Richard, and he's here. He's in studio. He'll be with us in just a second. Come on, Freeman. But, you know, sometimes it takes somebody being willing to talk about those terms that somebody has made into a bad word. That what's wrong with being angry in the situation that we find ourselves where, you know, you just had the Urban League report I was telling you about, where, you know, black Americans dealing with 72% of the equality of a white American. Why wouldn't somebody be angry about that? What, you know, why not? And we have the one, the only, let's see if we're ready here, live radio and TV, Kimmon Freeman, award-winning activist, playwright, co-owner of We Act Radio, guerrilla artist on Twitter, part of the recent delegation to Cuba.
Yeah, Mark.
And the star of his one-man show, Admit Whites Only. I love the description of this show so much. I read it to Shane and said, we have to go and see it. What happens when a millennial black man, activist, artist, father, radio producer talks to and about white folks unfiltered on stage? Kimmon, tell us about it.
Peace and blessings. Thank you for having me. We love it. We love it.
Absolutely.
You know, coming off the heels of the Black Lives Matter movement. And since that, obviously, forensic pathologist expert testimony, videotape murder, community of witnesses, a black attorney general, a black president, can't get one indictment for police murders. We were looking for a way to escalate the Black Lives Matter movement. And I felt that one of the arenas that this need to be fought in is in the realm of art and culture. And so this is a manifestation of that. A lot of times, most white people are not racist themselves because they don't know how to identify it. So when they hear someone say white supremacy, they say, well, I'm not a white supremacist. I'm not skinhead.
They think KKK extreme
right.
Examples.
And that's a extreme example. What we're talking about in this is more 21st century manifestations. So when you see a Latino movie with a Latino cast, a Latino director, that's for Latino audiences. When you see an Asian cast with an Asian director, that's an Asian film for Asian audiences. But if you see an all-white movie, all-white producers, all-white directors, all-white writers, white everything, that is just a film for everybody.
Excellent
That's white
point.
Supremacy, and that's yeah. What we're talking about. And that is the lens that we sometimes see the world, and we need to start to address that.
For the last half hour or so, one of the points I've mentioned on, and this is just a personal issue for me, that our society has turned this phrase, angry black man, into a pejorative, into some type of insult. And I find, I have a problem with that, that it's okay to be angry. I don't care who you are in today's society. If you're happy with the status quo, then, you know, you might need to explain things to me because I'm missing it. And I think that that phrase is powerful. It's mm-hmm. a good thing. And that's how we start to change.
Absolutely. And let me just say this. Well, I hate that it's necessary for me to say this, but white supremacy dicks takes that. if you feel some kind of way when someone says Black Lives Matter, yes, of course, all lives matter. But unfortunately, we're in a system where they allocate funds to the greatest military industrial complex in the world, and yet people are dying in their cars or bridges collapsing. So in that regard, they don't think all lives matter.
Right.
And apparently the police and the media and the courts and this judicial system and the criminal justice system doesn't think that all lives matter. So we are focusing on the ones that have been lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to shout out our sister, Dr. Stacey Patton. I don't have a quote in front of me, but she has written a very insightful, I think the most concise examination of white supremacy in an article entitled Loving Whites Won't Fix Racism.
I believe I read it. It was cross-posted at Alternate. If anybody wants to check it out, it's over there.
That's it. And we people owe it to ourselves to begin to examine this type of information. That's Dr. Stacey Patton. Also, Tim Wise is a wonderful white brother who's dedicated his life to addressing and dismantling on white supremacy. Because in the cornerstone, that is fundamentally the problem of the world, because there's a color caste system in every society, in every part of the globe. And that's a manifestation of that. So white supremacy is practiced primarily by people who are not themselves white.
I want to touch on your show, which people can still check out. It's March 26th at Busboys and Poets at 14th and V, and April 4th in Hyattsville, where I believe Shane and I will be attending.
That's
gonna be a big one. Yeah, we are so excited.
I'm trying to challenge the people speak in that production, and Howard Zinn was a big and had a big impact on my life.
I know how involved you are in so many different ways. And I know all of the stuff that you post that you're constantly working on. How did you find time to create this show, put it together, get it on stage?
Well, Angry Black Man Therapy, and the therapy is a lot of red wine. a lot of Jesus juice went into following the ancestors in this. And basically, it is also therapeutic to get things off your chest, if you will, rather than screaming at your television, incoherently screaming across the radio airways. I wanted to have a conversation that I think that has yet to have been had, and we just need to, look at it. And, I tell some vivid stories. This is not all meat and potatoes. There's a lot of, humor in this, because we need to laugh at ourselves sometimes. I think we laugh to keep from crying. And I try to, embody all of that. And I tell some stories of how I've seen racism experience, white supremacy in my life, manifested by other people, other than white people, of course. And it's just, the only thing I regret in doing this is that when I entitled it Whites Only, because that's my goal, to speak to an all-white audience, I didn't realize just how difficult it would be of attracting a white audience. And so a lot of my black friends was like, well, no one's white is going to come. I said, well, why don't you just bring one of your white friends? And they're like, I don't have any. And I was like, now how are you going to talk about white people? How do you know anything? You know, say you don't even know any white people, And, so I'm a little disappointed doing this production with all black audience, with a few white people sprinkled here that's brave enough to come out. But I just want you to know that I'm not beating up on white people. We're beating up on the institutional white supremacy. So it's not like I'm calling someone out. In fact, a white guy saved my life. So that there's, if anything, is someone who, you ever see the movie, with Ed Norton, American History X?
Yes.
I think that's a concise examination of how you make someone into a racist. And then just start to dismantle that.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what I'm tapping into, because not that black people can possibly be racist people. Racist means that I am somehow affecting your forward movement and upper mobility in life because of my prejudices.
Yeah.
So unless I'm doing that, I am not a racist, But with having said that, I at one time was the typical I hate white people person until I had a few experiences that made me come in grips with that. And so we confuse with hating a white supremacist institutional system with the people that we see walking down the street. And as Lyndon B. Johnson would have said, if you give the lowest white man something to look down on, if you make him feel as if he's better than the best black man, he won't notice that you're picking his pocket. If you give him something to look down on, hell, he would empty his pockets for you. And that is how we get a lot, 99% white folks to vote against their own self-interest in the hopes of identifying with the 1%.
Yeah, creating the other. We have a quick 4-minute Free Speech TV break if you want to do some special extra commentary for our Free Speech TV audience.
Free speech.
One second. Let's run to a quick break. Kimmon Freeman, check it out. Admit Whites Only.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Find out all the information and RSVP for your show. I'm talking to you, white people, at PopularResistance.org. Welcome back. I'm still here with Kimmon Freeman, the star of the one-man show, A Black Man in Therapy, Whites Only, challenging white people to come out and see it again March 26th at the Busboys and Poets at 14th and V, April 4th in Hyattsville, Maryland, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern each day, $10 RSVP, and you can check it out at PopularResistance.org. Kimmon, you are one of my favorite people to talk to in general, but especially When it comes to issues like this that are hard-hitting because you're not afraid to speak truth to power, is that what people can expect to see in the show?
Absolutely. A new point of view, for instance, let's take the Mike Brown case. We're all familiar with it, but we've only seen it through the lens of a particular Six Corporation's view.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just take the lens of race off of it and just use our common sense. Okay, you're a young guy. You stole some cigars or whatever, and everyone has stole something in their entire life unless you're Mother Teresa. And you're walking down the street, and a cop is not stopping you. He's just telling you, hey, get out the street and walk mm-hmm. on the sidewalk. So you decide, based upon that, to attack the officer, to go for his gun, despite you going to college in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it sounds totally plausible.
You want to end it right here. Let's get it on right here, you know. And so you get shot in the process of going after the cop's gun. So you take off running. Now, you start to run, and about 30 or 40 feet, while he's still shooting at you, you decide, I want to turn around and change my mind and charge the officer who is shooting at me in a football tackle position from 30 or 40 feet away.
Yeah.
That's only plausible if you're a believer of white supremacy institutions.
There are so many examples like that. That one was one, I think, that grabbed national attention because for so many of us, it was so cut and dried, where the narrative from the institutions just didn't seem plausible, and still don't.
Right.
And
let me explain something to all the listeners that were saying, well, you know, he was violent, he was big, he was scary, he got like a demon. His pecs are sagging, you know, all that. He's dark-skinned, all that, all the stereotypes. Let me read this for them. This is an excerpt from the play. Martin Luther King Jr. wore suits, loved Jesus, and embraced nonviolence, spoke the Queen's English, had a top-notch education, said grace before he ate, and said his prayers before he went to sleep. However, none of that spared him white supremacy's wrath. And that is because white supremacy is neither rational nor moral. It cannot be calmed or reasoned with. It cannot be coddled or soothed. It doesn't play nice. There's no behavior that you can display that would temper its rage against your existence. It doesn't care about the red bottoms on your shoes or the length of your skirt or the hook of your hoodie or the sag of your pants. And while you believe that respectability is a way in which you can exercise control over the uncontrollable, your belief is a misnomer, a sideshow, a distraction, an illusion, cognitive dissonance. White supremacy means to extinguish your light simply because it shines, point blank, in the story. And so, therefore, we have a world where college frat boys singing about hanging Negroes get police protection, and black people screaming Black Lives Matter get arrested.
Yeah. I mean, we just saw in Jackson, Mississippi, where my father, at one point in his life with his father, was stationed there because the military said it was the most racist place he'd ever been in his entire life.
Where was this?
Jackson, Mississippi.
Jackson,
and we just saw an actual lynching, and they put the victim's mugshot up to identify him.
Is that right? And the words of Nina Simone, Mississippi, God damn.
Yeah, exactly. Come on.
Real quick, footnote. Ronald Reagan, their favorite president, actually launched his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And that's only known for one thing.
Racism.
Two dead Jews and a black guy in the backseat.
Tom talks about that all the time. Come on, Freeman, everybody. A black man in therapy. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, still here with Shano, in for Tom. And let's go to Bob Ney of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, free-don.org, and goatsfortheoldgoats.com. Bob, thank you so much. What's in the news today?
Thank you. Well, the big announcement, at least on the Republican side, for some, is that Senator Ted Cruz, is officially running for president of the United States. So it's caused a lot of internal discussions. Of course, I can remember different primaries. And I compare this, I think it's comparable for most of the Republican side, to Rick Santorum when he ran against Mitt Romney. And Rick Santorum, former senator from Pennsylvania, by the way, may run again. But it's kind of comparable. You know, Santorum made the checklist, just like Ted Cruz does. Ted Cruz checks out 10 for 10 on the agenda for his base, the far right. However, so did Rick Santorum, and Mitt Romney, a, quote, lefty or a rhino, Republican in name only, however you want to term him, beat Rick Santorum handily. So I think the same thoughts are out there about Ted Cruz of where this will end up, but it's going to make for some great theater.
It's certainly going to make for some great theater. I worry because we had a guest on yesterday that talked about his background and how he's got connections to Paul Weyrich and Jerry Falwell and a lot of the, you know, really conservative, strong organizations like American Family Association and Heritage Foundation. Do those groups still take him seriously, or are they looking at this potential run as a bit of a joke as well?
No, I think that a lot of groups, certain groups, I should say, not a lot, but certain groups take him seriously. I mean, if you look where he made his announcement at, you know, Liberty University, Falwell's institution, where, as I understand it, people were required to be there, and that's why he had to.
I did see that as well.
They were required. So I don't know if it was part of the course or, you know, a grade or whatever. But, you know, there are some people that absolutely, just as they would Senator Santorum back during the Mitt Romney primary, they would like to have Ted Cruz. Now, I don't know in Ted Cruz's mind whether he actually, A, believes he can be president to get through the primary at least, or whether he's just doing this to, you know, trumpet a cause, or if he's just doing it to get more attention and one can raise money and stay in the Senate. I mean, I don't know because I'm not inside of his head, but I will tell you there are supporters that firmly believe he can and will win the presidency.
It's certainly strange days we live in. What else is going on?
Well, the big story in D.C., there's a couple. There was an announcement that Speaker John Boehner is going to Israel at the end of the month. By the way, his last trip, I was on that trip with him to Israel, which I would note, it was Jordan and Israel at that time. We went to both. It was back in 2008, and if I recall correctly, it was his first trip outside the United States. So he hasn't been there since 2008, and so they can kind of gin this up or spin it any way they want. You don't all of a sudden say, oh, let's see, I haven't been to Israel since 2008. I think I'll hop over now as Speaker of the House.
This is this was, kind of one hand washing the other for him inviting Netanyahu here to speak to Congress?
Yes, this is part of a strategy. I believe from John Boehner's end, this is part of a money-raising political strategy for 2016 in an attempt to get supporters, Jewish supporters in particular, to go towards the Republican Party. Also, there is no question in my mind, Boehner will raise money by visiting Israel, not within Israel, but over here from some supporters of his. And then there are those who will delight in any type of differences between that are further between Netanyahu and President Obama. There was a story that arose today about the fact that Israel spied on the Iran negotiations. They say, Israel says, through Netanyahu, I shouldn't say Israel, but through Netanyahu, a spokesperson says they didn't spy. They were given information by other people involved with the meetings. The U.S. officials have recognized that Israel spies on America and America spies on Israel, so that's nothing new. But the fact that this was used to go after American diplomacy is a little bit unusual. And Boehner's visit over there will try to achieve that purpose to wreck any potential talks with President Obama. I mean, after all, with the Iranian negotiations, we don't even know what the deal is yet. So, you know, there are some who are completely condemning the deal that we, again, just don't know what it is at this point in time.
Yeah.
Although I will note Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, has said, well, there won't be a vote till later on. At least he is waiting to condemn whatever comes out. Then he'll vote against it.
Well, maybe that's where leaked information got to Republicans through Israeli spies. I mean, that's the so-called deal that the Iran letter was written about. It's really strange, the relationship between the Republicans and the leader of another nation. It's very strange. Ally or not, they seem to act like he's our president.
Yes, and it doesn't necessarily translate to votes. I mean, one must remember that Israel is a democracy. There are people that, although they elected Netanyahu, his party, and he's prime minister, there are still people with differences of opinions. It's not a dictatorship. Israel is a great democracy, and we've been friends. It's just that in a very, very unusual step, Speaker Boehner was able to inject politics as we have not viewed it in decades between the two countries. And again, I was on the last trip in 2008. He's waited 7 years to all of a sudden decide to go to Israel. So Speaker Boehner's people can spin it any way they want. This is definitely to get back at President Obama by the Speaker of the House. It's kind of a pre-2016 launch.
Very strange. Anything else in the couple minutes or so we have left?
Well, just one issue is the Confederate flag issue before the Supreme Court, and it's about license plates and what you can put on license plates. Texas doesn't want to allow the Confederate flag. There are some people arguing at the court. In fact, it should be allowed. And then Justice Ginsburg asked the question, well, if you allowed the Confederate symbol on the plate, could you allow jihad and ISIS and other the swastikas? And I think the man answered, well, yes, in a free speech country. So it seems like a trivial issue, but I think the court will probably pass this back that states can basically determine what's on the license plate. On a positive note, the president had a science fair. There's some private money going into promotion of science across the country that the president's been able to put together. And he had some children to the White House to unveil their projects.
Well, that at least, thankfully, is ending on a positive note. Bob Ney, right. Talk Radio News Service, and author of Sideswiped. Go check it out now. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I am Danielle, in here with Shano, filling in for Tom today. Big thanks to Kimon Friedman of Angry Black Man in Therapy. I'm so excited to see that show, and I really hope that other people listening will check it out. And as if we didn't have enough great topics today, we had to jump to one more with the lovely, the talented, the one and only brilliant Desi Doyen of the Green News Report. You can check it out over at greennews.bradblog.com. Desi, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Hey, Danielle, always a pleasure to talk to you. We don't get to do that nearly enough.
No, we don't. And there was a rather serious article up over at the Brad Blog today, just a few days ago, about mandatory water rationing in California. As most of us know, California, worst drought in decades, if not longer. You live there, and you happen to know a thing or two about Green News. What are your thoughts on water rationing?
Oh, wow. It's a big deal and a very, very contentious potential issue here for California. The article at bradblog.com, you can check out the video there. It's our lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom, who has said basically that, listen, we're all sort of talking privately about the concept of instituting mandatory rationing in California simply because this drought is so bad that it's not looking like it's going to let up anytime soon. And it is the worst recorded drought in California history, and that's going back about 150 years.
Wow.
And it's a combination of a number of things. You know, it's not just a lack of rainfall that's hitting us. It's also the heat. We've had our hottest winter on record in California, the hottest January and the hottest February on record in California. And so the heat exacerbates the drought by drying out the ground and drying out soil moisture as well. And so what that's doing is that's having a number of cascading consequences. What happens is that in the agriculture area. That's the Central Valley of California, from which, you know, the United States gets like 40-50% of its fruits and vegetables and nuts. That basically the Central Valley has not been getting enough rainwater, so they've been drawing down on their reservoirs, and their reservoirs are drawing down quite a bit and not refilling because of the lack of rain. So now farmers are drilling wells willy-nilly across the Central Valley. I mean, for them, it is a necessity just to stay in business, to be able to have the kind of water that they need to maintain some of the thirstiest crops that are grown in the United States. Now, you could question the wisdom of growing thirsty crops like, say, almond orchards and expanding those almond orchards in the middle of a known drought. That's something that a lot of folks are questioning right now about, well, why was that even allowed? Why would you do that? Why would you know that you're in a drought and plant the thirstiest possible orchard that must be watered year-round, your fields cannot be allowed to go fallow, and draw on your groundwater. The groundwater is like your seed corn. Once the groundwater is gone, it's gone. It takes thousands of years, in some cases, to recharge the groundwater. So we have this really major situation going on here, and it's not getting any better. And that's what Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom was talking about. Now, Governor Jerry Brown, he has instituted some emergency drought measures. Last January 2014, he declared that in California it was a state of emergency, a drought emergency. But the responses since then have been surprisingly sort of weak tea. We had this big bond issue in November where voters voted for $7 billion in funding that would help with midterm and long-term drought mitigation, water resourcing, water conservation, water efficiency, water delivery, you know, desalination, all of these issues. But they're really for mid to long-term. They're not really addressing the short term. And I think that's what Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom is saying. You know, we're going to have to look at this and look at it seriously.
Yeah, it takes some bravery to come out and make comments like this, even when they are the necessary comments, when this may be the necessary next step. I do commend Gavin Newsom for being brave enough to come out and call for this. What do you say to the statements that California only has 1 year of water left? I saw that story come out, a lot of attention on it, and now I've seen people trying to kind of walk back that remark.
Trying to basically explain what that specifically means. It's a JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, here in Pasadena. One of the scientists, the senior water scientist, Jay Familetti, came out and he said, listen, this is what we're measuring via satellites. And he's talking about stored water in California reservoirs. The headline writer at the LA Times really did write a bombshell of a headline, but it doesn't exactly get the truth across. So they've since changed the headline at the LA Times. But basically, 1 year of stored water in reservoirs is a very serious issue because different reservoirs around the state have, you know, different water users that they're contracted to. So here in Southern California, our water managers have managed to keep the reservoirs pretty full. So we're probably going to be all right, but it's the folks in the Central Valley that have been drawing down their reservoirs and drawing down their groundwater that are going to be facing problems probably as soon as this summer. So when he says 1 year of stored water left in our reservoirs, meaning that we'll then have to go to the groundwater, and that's what is already happening right now. I mean, it's ridiculous. There are drilling companies that are working, they say, in the Central Valley, 24 hours a day,
wow,
trying to keep up with the demand to poke new holes and put new straws down into this one common water source.
Now, as you said, a lot of what's drawing the water there are crops. Obviously, the state of California may have to implement water rationing, mandatory or voluntary at this point. But what can people who aren't in the state do? I mean, could we change our buying habits, our eating habits, to maybe lend a hand to the folks suffering this long-term drought in California that's likely to expand?
That's an excellent question. You know, there's a big fight going on right now, sort of a looming fight going on right now, because specifically as it refers to almonds. Almonds are a huge cash crop that pay very, very much to the farmers that grow them because they have a high value. And so, but they also are very water intensive. They're the thirstiest tree you can plant, apparently. So when it comes to this boom in almond milk and almond products, you know, it's an unintentional side effect that, of course, farmers are going to flock to that kind of crop. And that crop is unfortunately one that is going to not work in a desert area that's really not suited to it. I mean, it's got the sunshine, this doesn't have the water. So one of the things that people can do is they can maybe seek out alternatives when it comes to, you know, their love of almond milk or finding other places where it can be sourced. You know, what's interesting is that, you know, much of California's fruits, nuts, and vegetables are exported. So they're exported to Japan, they're exported to China, they're exported to Asia. So all of our water is essentially getting tied up in these exports.
Wow.
We can also reduce, it's kind of an interesting thing when you start thinking about the amount of water that goes into growing the hay, that goes into feeding the cows, that then go to the dairy farm or off to the slaughterhouse. And it turns out that the production of animals, specifically cattle in the Central Valley, is a huge user of water. It dwarfs almonds. It dwarfs lawns. It dwarfs pretty much any other user in the entire state. So, you know, it's some interesting things. You know, when you look at changing our diets, for example, transitioning to a lesser meat consumption diet, a lesser dairy consumption diet, you know, there are things that we can do that can help reduce the water stress in California. But there are some scientists who say, you know, if this is the beginning of, say, a mega drought, which has been predicted for the Southwest by 2050, if it's happening starting now, then that means that really this could be the beginning of the end of Central Valley, California agriculture, which is a quite shocking thought.
Well, hopefully people are trying to figure out what to do long term. And, hey, I will say personally that I may have to give up the almond milk after talking to you, Desi. I can skip meat without a problem, but I'll have to switch the almond milk. But thank you very much for breaking this down for us and making it so that we can contribute and help the folks in California who are suffering under this drought.
Thanks, Daniel.
Desi Doyen, everybody. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There are ways we can help. You can check them out over at greennews.bradblog.com. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program.
I can just
here.
See your face on the almond milk. It just grew very long.
Oh, yes.
I could just see my pistachios going away.
Yeah, I could easily go without meat, something I know some people couldn't, but I am very attached to the almond milk. Maybe we can buy it from a more sustainable source that's not in California.
Okay.
Maybe we can find some imported almond milk.
Okay.
Anyhow, lots of people want to weigh in. We are going to nothing but your calls for the rest of the show. So let's check in with Paul, watching on Free Speech TV in South Lyon, Michigan. Paul, I'm so glad you called today. Sorry it took so long to get to you, and as well to other people waiting on the board.
Oh, that's all right. You guys are always worth the wait.
Aw.
As always, you and Shane are making Tom proud while he's away.
We try. Nobody can really fill Tom's shoes. We just try our best to copy them and hope that you guys won't notice.
Well, you're doing a great job.
Thanks.
Speaking of Ted Cruz, let's leave him alone because he's going to become the nominee because God's on his side.
Did he say this?
Did he say this?
Well, that's the implication. You know, he's, yeah. You know, his dad's a preacher and, you know.
Yeah, Liberty certainly, University, if you ask Rafael Cruz, although some Bruce Wilson, who we spoke to the other day when I spoke to, you know, on the side there, said Rafael predicted Ted would be vice president. And I think that there's a lot of substantial reason to fear that thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so if Ted Cruz doesn't become vice president, that means God hates him, I guess, right?
It makes sense to me. Perfect. Hey, if A plus B equals C, you know, hey, why not?
Yeah, right.
You had some thoughts on our earlier guest.
Yeah, I'm an economist, and you guys brilliantly pointed out one of the con jobs of Republican trickle-down nonsense, which I won't call economics because it's not. And that is, with Republican tax cuts, middle-class people might save a few dollars. You know, Shane pointed this out. Well, billionaires save millions of dollars a year, but we lose our roads, schools, our clean air and water, mm-hmm. our food safety, our Social Security, and our Medicare. Not a very good trade-off for $22 a year, is it?
Oh, if you look at the conservative budget, Shane was looking at it earlier.
Wow.
Paul, I challenge you to go and check out the conservative budget and give us a call back later in the week because the entire thing is just what they're going to eliminate, you know, cut from the EPA, cut the destroy the National Labor Relations Board. There are so many points that they want to abolish. There would be a skeleton of government actually left.
And the budget we're looking at, if you go to flores.house.gov, and then look for the conservative study group's budget. This is the conservative caucus's budget, not the GOP budget, not the essentially the Ryan budget redo. This is the conservative. It's an amazing thing. And when you talk about infrastructure, Danielle and I, on the way into work, have been counting the number of potholes that we believe are actually going to turn into sinkholes.
Yes.
I mean, with the kind of weather we've had and the lack of funding for infrastructure, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Not only does the Republican trickle-down not help the economy, it actually destroys the economy, like we saw in 07 and 08, and we're seeing in Kansas, Wisconsin, et cetera. And also, your guest mentioned this Republican dynamic scoring,
yes,
which is really just dynamic lying.
Yeah.
Are you guys familiar with that?
Yes, absolutely. Essentially, to add a little trickle-down fairy dust to every economic calculation.
Nonsense. Yeah. That the economy is going to grow so much if they cut taxes.
We are out of time. But, Paul, always brilliant comments, and hopefully we'll hear from you again later this week. Paul, watching on Free Speech. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Big thanks to Desi Doyen of the Green News Report. If you haven't subscribed over on iTunes, you should. 6 minutes of amazing green news coverage, along with about 2 or 3 dozen other stories that she doesn't have time to get to.
Twice a week.
Yes, twice a week. Amazing work.
Yes.
We are continuing with your calls here today. Let's check in with Victor, watching on Free Speech TV in Temple, Texas. Victor, thanks for watching the Tom Hartman Program.
Carol.
Hi.
Listen, I'd like to say that you and Shano are doing such a wonderful job for Tom Hartman. I've been a long time watcher of the show. I called very, very few times because so many smart people are out there in America that call this show. It's just shameful how brilliant they are when you get to somebody that's in a Republican state that has been transformed here from the bowels of Detroit to where deep in the heart of the ghetto in Detroit, Michigan, to where things were really, really bad back in the late 70s, early 80s. Coming down here to Texas, you get a real good feel for what racism is really, really, really about here. And that gentleman, or I shouldn't call him that, but the senator that's running for vice president here.
Ted Cruz. Yes.
I said vice president, slip of the tongue there, but he's on the delusion that he wants to be president here. And can't you in America imagine what it would be like if we had Mitt Romney as the president instead of Barack Obama? I hate to think of how the way things would really be.
I certainly wonder what proposals he would introduce and how that would change things. But sometimes I do wonder that if Congress would have cooperated with him more, if that could be just as scary, if not more so,
or even scarier, John McCain as president.
That really scares me.
We would be in Iran right now.
Yes, if not other places as well.
Oh yeah,
but
absolutely.
Victor, all excellent points. I can only imagine what you have seen. Going from Detroit to Texas,
right. That
is quite a scenery change.
And in terms of thinking of Mitt Romney as our president, if he had been elected, I think that's why we're bringing up these proposals and trying to go into them in a lot of depth here, because that would be essentially the policy outcome of a Republican president next time around.
Yeah.
And kind of setting up the warning flares.
Right. I mean,
not, you know, a lot of people do know that, yeah, it would be bad, but here are the ways. Let me count them.
Right. I mean, we talk about Ted Cruz, make some jokes, and try and get into his background. But the point, the real point is to try and say, this is what you would get with a Ted Cruz presidency. And, you know, if you like the policies that Paul Weyrich and the religious right have helped implement and have continued to fight for, then, hey, Ted's your guy. But if you think that those are destroying our country, you may want to take his candidacy seriously and make sure that he doesn't ever get in or a heartbeat away from the White House.
I like that.
Yes.
In or a heartbeat away from.
But, Victor, excellent points. Let's check in with Joe, listening on Progressive Voices on TuneIn in Chevy Chase, Maryland. You had some thoughts on Ted Cruz as well.
They do. Hello?
We're here. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah, yeah. With respect to Ted Cruz, I'm more of a libertarian type guy, so I agree with him on about 70% of what he thinks. But I also find it, and definitely not on his social stuff, but I find it really amusing about how the left in general treats him. I mean, they all dismiss him as, you know, extreme and not very smart and all this other kind of stuff. When you, although it's hysterical, because when you compare his, and then at the same time they talk about Barack Obama, about how, oh, the smartest guy in the world and Harvard.
Yeah, Joe, did you listen to the show yesterday? Because, you know, obviously you may have missed us saying that he is not the dumb individual that some people.
I'm talking about most of the left. You did, but also when you say things about, I think what Ted Cruz could add to the conversation is some sort of intelligent discussion about the constitutional limits on power. I mean, you know, you guys constantly say how afraid you are of somebody like Ted Cruz. My God, you should be scared to death of what Obama has done for the separations of power in this country, depending on. You know, it's not about what his policies are. I mean, the left is so willing to say, oh, we like this. So whatever power the president exerts to get this or that, it's okay. Well, let's take your fears, which is overstated and hyperbole. Okay, so let's say Ted Cruz becomes president. You know that Obama has set the precedent that Ted Cruz could just unilaterally abolish all of Obamacare just by executive order?
No, he has not. What Obama's executive order was within laws already passed by Congress. That is the executive power that he exerted. Actually ignoring a law, actually repealing it, a president can't do. And that precedent was not set up here.
Yeah. And Joe, you know, we could certainly agree to disagree, but I'm not going to just have you filibuster and make points that aren't true. Let's go to one other quick call in Arkansas. Henry, listening on Sirius in Osceola, Arkansas. Thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program, Henry.
Hey, how y'all doing? Look, I just want to say real quick about the young lady talking about the water crisis they have in California.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is my opinion, and it's been like this over the years because, you know, I go up to California a lot, haul produce, things of that nature out of there. But see, the thing I never figured out, they had a billionaire years ago left money to the state of California to build a desalination plant for the water for the state. But instead, the state just pretty much, you know, wiped that money out, did what they want to do. And the sad part of the whole situation is, you know, desalination plants actually help California because they can use that water for crops and things of that nature.
Henry, there are so many examples of what we could have done if we had thought long term. We'll be back with more.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Excellent point there by Henry in Arkansas. Sorry to cut it so short, but he makes a great point. We need to look to the future now while we can. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Danielle, here with Shano, sitting in for Tom today. So many great topics, many great guests, and, of course, so many of your wonderful calls that we're going to keep getting to for the rest of the show, starting with Max watching on Free Speech TV in Napa, California. You might have some thoughts on the drought there, huh, Max?
Yes. I have a thought about the population
factor that's not being acknowledged at all. There's no consideration to the reversing, ideally, the growth. It's continuous growth, and how can we continually grow on a finite planet and a finite resources?
Yeah, I certainly agree with you in general, but there are other countries that are doing something about it, countries that have negative population growth because people aren't having children. Some countries are even addressing the fact because, you know, for instance, like us, where the next generation helps pay for Social Security, you have similar situations in other countries where there isn't going to be that next generation. It's not going to be large enough to support their social safety net. But it's a tough topic to bring up when we talk about climate, when we talk about food scarcity, economic scarcity.
It brings up thoughts of totalitarian regimes,
right,
putting limits on children and things like that, and family engineering and all that. And
but
it
how
gives
do you,
me the heebie-jeebies.
Right, but how do you solve the problem without at least talking about all the possibilities?
I think empowering women is the best way.
Amen.
Right. As soon as you empower women who actually have the options available to them economically, and I'm talking about this worldwide, economically, socially, and have control over their own body decisions, population growth will definitely go down.
Yeah, but Max, excellent point. Thank you very much for the call. Let's check in with Roger, listening on Sirius in Lake Ariel, Pennsylvania. Roger, thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to refute what that young man was talking about earlier, who claimed that he's a libertarian and he agrees with 70% of what the senator from Texas is. I find it incredulous that a libertarian would agree with a religious right individual. And more than likely, to put them together, we would have to use some of that dish detergent, the ingredients that Tom was talking about in one of his programs last week, so they can mesh together.
The emulsifier.
Emulsifiers. We need an idea emulsifier.
Well, demulsifier, whatever Tom was talking about last week, that's not important. The important part is that I wanted to make the point that the left is pretty much geriatric or dead. You know, all the leftists I know, they have maybe 7-8 hairs to hold their ponytail together. They're dead. The left is no longer here. And people tend to keep putting Obama in the left group or column. He's not. When there was a serious left channel, we had a leftist host. He had the chairman of the Socialist Party on interviewing him. Mm-hmm. And the first question was asked, what is Obama? And the answer was, he's a Republican.
Yeah,
he's certainly a moderate. Yeah,
Roger, I certainly agree with you that he wouldn't be what I would consider left, but I actually disagree when we say there's no left out there. First off, I just want to quickly note that I get so frustrated when we allow people like that caller turn the left into a bad word.
Right.
I am proud to be left. You can call me a liberal. You could call me a left wing. We were joking earlier in the show. It wouldn't be the first time I've been called a commie.
Right.
You know, I have no problem with that. But I think we're out here. I think progressives are just itching for a candidate and ideas that we can get behind and really rally. I mean, look at the climate march. Look at Occupy. Look at the protests in the streets all over the world. I think the left is alive and well, and the corporate media just doesn't want us to know about it.
Right. And speaking of Ted Cruz and liberty, this is from his speech yesterday. Imagine millions of young people coming together and standing together saying, "We will stand for liberty," which was delivered to a room full of people that were being forced to be there. Mrs. Gracie of DU as well.
Yes.
Think of the irony in that one.
It is. I understand what your point is, Roger, and I certainly don't disagree in that, you know, people like to lump all of this in together and turn it into some type of negative or a bad word, and we can't let them do that. And we could stand a president that is far more progressive than President Obama. I won't disagree there. Let's check in with Bob watching on Free Speech TV in Holland, Michigan. Bob, you had some thoughts on capital gains tax.
Yeah, I am curious as to why it's never been brought up to make overtime tax-free. Let me give you an example. When I was working, if I worked 41 hours I took home less money than if I worked 40 hours. And, you know, the right wants to say, well, we put this money into the economy if we cut capital gains and it will stir growth or whatever. How about giving people that are actually working that tax benefit?
Interestingly enough, Bob, Paul Ryan, he didn't want to make it tax-free. He just wanted to make sure you didn't get time and a half for it. That was his plan, and the Republican... Remember, they wanted to call flex time.
Oh yeah, flex time. So you didn't you could work 60 hours one week and then work 20 a different week, but you would never get any more. I understand essentially what happens in those situations, and this does happen often, where as soon as you work that 1 hour of overtime, because the whatever payroll company is doing to your paycheck, you've been bumped into a higher tax bracket because it's going to assume that you make that same amount every week and that's your tax rate.
Right.
In the end, though, when you file your return and all that, it actually doesn't. You don't get taxed more. You actually do end up with that money, but in the short term, which is really what most people are living on right now, that really shouldn't happen. If you work more hours, you should get more pay. That's more a function of how payroll services work, though.
Yeah, I will say that it's one of those ideas that the right would have a hard time campaigning against, and it would be a really progressive tax because, let's face it, people who collect dividend checks don't work a lot of overtime.
No. Well, but the thing is that the right won't campaign against it. They don't There are plenty of situations in which progressives or moderate Democrats have put out tax cuts, and they just vote them down.
Right.
They don't actually, you know, say, we're against this tax cut. They just filibuster it, and they're done with it.
Right. And just to clarify what I just said, I know lots of people, especially small business owners, who might be on salary, who work more than 40 hours, but they're not getting the time and a half payment. So it would be, but there are lots of people who work more than 40 hours.
There are droves of definitions during the Bush administration where they defined different jobs as not even eligible for the time and a half, the overtime, you know, all kinds of administrative type duties. And it was an expansive group of people who used to get a time and a half and then no longer did. And they're actually going back through it and trying to redefine these back. For example, bank tellers.
Mm-hmm.
They're calling it administrative, and therefore you work 50 hours and you got 50 hours straight.
It would be an interesting way to give working people a tax cut.
It would be.
It's definitely food for thought. Thank you for the excellent suggestion, Bob, listening, watching there in Michigan. Let's check in with – oh, hang on. Sorry, my board just shifted. Let's check in with Chris, listening on KBAI in Bellingham, Washington. Chris?
Hello?
You're on the air?
Hi, how you doing?
I'm here.
Hey, I just wanted to make a point about overtime pay. Overtime pay was not meant to be a premium for the employee. It was designed to be a penalty for the employer for not scheduling work properly or not having enough employees. The fact that someone needs overtime pay to get by means they're not getting paid enough.
I think that's
a really
excellent
point.
Excellent point, Chris.
And that's probably why people like Paul Ryan are trying to get rid of it. They hate penalizing employers. And if it actually is a penalty, I think he's right. They don't want to pay the penalty, so the solution to that is actually hire more employers.
Right.
So it is. A time and a half is a way to encourage employers to hire more employees, and therefore unemployment goes down. If you get rid of that penalty, if you go to this flex time thing, you can take advantage of fewer employees and not hire as many.
Right.
It all makes sense.
Interesting suggestions, as we often say. Tom's listeners, smartest listeners in the world. Let's check in with Jeff, listening on KABQ 1350 AM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thanks for listening to KABQ, Jeff.
Thank you. I actually just called in actually to correct some misinformation put forward by the self-identified libertarian caller a little earlier.
Poor Joe.
Poor Joe. Joe, you know, he might honestly believe what he's talking about.
Well, the first idea is this notion that President Obama has somehow disproportionately used executive orders.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, and I emphasize in fact, both President Bush's, President Reagan, President Clinton, and a slew of other presidents have all issued more executive orders than President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
The second point is that it's important to remember that President Obama is a former constitutional law professor,
mm-hmm.
and the seminal case on the subject is the Youngstown Steel case from 1945. And I can assure you that all of his executive orders have been within the framework which was created by that Supreme Court decision. Now, the truly sad part in my mind is that Ted Cruz knows that as well.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he gets up there and makes public statements to the contrary when he is clearly not a dumb person is, to me at least, you know, clear and convincing evidence that he is basically full of crap.
I often wonder about that, wonder about people who are obviously intelligent and if they possibly believe what they're talking about or if they're...
Unconstitutional executive amnesty.
Right, that's the new phrase. Yeah. But perfectly said, perfectly stated, Jeff. Concise, wonderful. Where were you a minute ago? What? Thanks for listening to KABQ. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Danielle and Shano, sitting in for Tom, will be back with your calls. Welcome back to Free Speech TV, Tom Hartman program. Lots of great calls today. Let's check in with Damien listening. Oh, I'm sorry, Damien. I thought you were a Free Speech TV caller. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere, and we'll check in with Brian, watching on DirecTV in Matthews, North Carolina. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, Brian.
Thank you. How are you guys doing?
We are doing very well. Thank you.
Well, just between yourself, Shane, and me, you guys are slowly removing Tom from that chair.
Nobody could fill those shoes. As I said earlier, we're just faking it and hoping that you guys buy it.
Now, I don't do that for an instant. Look at the generation you've got in the past couple of days. I'm going to piggyback off the call you had a couple of callers ago with the gentleman saying the left and the right. I hate all this name-calling because the results are the same no matter what group you're affecting. It's all the same. So the gentleman was describing Ted Cruz as being some great, intelligent guy. We never said this. He was watching yesterday's show. We stated that a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
He is so smart. But if you're so smart, you're doing stupid things, then what are you going to go by?
Right. And when somebody that smart is doing things that I feel are so wrong for the country, the word that comes to mind for me is evil. Now, I'm not saying evil as in, you know, possessed by the devil or any nonsense like that. I mean evil as in inhuman, not able to realize how it affects your fellow man.
Or to quote the great Forrest Gump, stupid is as stupid does.
Yes.
You may be brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, the other point I want to make was, Shane hit in the last hour about the when the racism occurs in bad times. And I just want to take a little pushback on that one. It's always there. It's just that when you're working and the economy's going strong, it's kind of a distraction. You don't see, you don't have time to engage in it as much. When the economy's down, it's more, you know, that picture that you see on the wall from 10 feet away is almost like it's 2 feet away. Now you can see everything much more clearly. You're aggravated. You're at home unemployed. Now all the issues that you see every day that you haven't been able to see before because you were working or asleep, they're there. So now you're indoctrinated. You're aggravated. You're mad as heck. And you're blaming everybody.
Yeah, you want somebody to blame, and it's always easy to blame the person who doesn't look like you.
And you certainly don't want to blame Reaganomics. It's easier to have, you know, say, blame the person over there for your lousy lot in life, not our terrible policies.
Right. But no, they really did an actual study. I am channeling Tom and have buried it in on the desk. But they really did an actual study to prove that people look at race differently when they think that economic resources are scarce. They actually have a different viewpoint in their mind. But I think both are valid points, Brian. I totally agree that, you know, when times are going well, people aren't focused on it so much. When times aren't going so well, we tend to look for somebody to blame.
And the come on, gentleman that was on earlier, he stole my platform. I've been saying that for years. If you have someone lower, I've had friends. I have more white friends than black friends, obviously. But for years I've always had people come up to me and you're this, you're that, or whatever, and I look at a situation, I would turn it around them. Look at them financially. And not just finances is the only thing, but if that's what we see, then you attack at that point.
Yeah.
I have a phone out, but where are you? Where, how come you don't have this? Whatever. Why am I so much less blessed than you are?
Yeah.
You couldn't explain it.
I think there's definitely an economic point in that discussion, but I do think that there are institutions in this country that are still very discriminatory based solely on race. And the protections about against that are dwindling. They're going away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Damien, listening on Sirius in Manorville, New York. Sorry about that, Damien. Tried to pick you up during the Free Speech TV break.
Not a problem. Before I make my statement, I just wanted to touch point two things on what you have said since I've been on hold. One, you were talking about Republicans are racist because 95% of the Republican Party are white.
No, that's not what I said.
Correct? What did you say exactly?
I said it's easy to see how someone would draw that parallel.
Well, okay. Well, I think that's kind of like, you know, a slight on that. I mean, we could also look at it as that 96% of African Americans voted for the Democrat African American candidate.
No, the stat.
You can look at it from both ways.
No, here, actually, so, we can't. You know, hang on one sec. Hang on one sec. The stat that Danielle was quoting was the population of Republican people who go to the caucus in the primaries. That 95% of Republicans themselves, not who they voted for, of the makeup of the party, 95% white, 5% black. That's the stat.
Right. But, okay. Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, people tend to vote along not just vote, but tend to be friends or hang around people who look like them. I mean, on both sides of the aisle. But I also wanted to also see something that you had said. You said, well, I've been called commie. I've been called lefty. I don't care. You don't care if somebody calls you a communist? You're okay
if they're trying to make it a derogatory term and they
okay
obviously, Damien, if you're going to filibuster, I'm just going to hang up on you.
No, I'm not. Yeah. But I mean, are you okay with that?
I'm okay with that because most of the people who throw that term around don't actually understand what it means.
And they would know that she's not.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I just wanted to make a comment then on the gentleman who was on about the angry black man. You know, I think that, you know, no one can deny that there's been institutional racism.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. There were laws on the books that prevented African Americans from actually participating in our democracy, and they were second-class citizens. Anybody conservative or not, you can't deny that.
No, I appreciate that you can acknowledge that.
Of course. Absolutely. Anybody who says that doesn't understand history.
But
my point, though, is I think that what would be, and this is my perspective. Unfortunately, some people say you're a white male. We don't need your perspective. But I think everybody's voice should be valid and respected. I think that every community should be worried about their own community. But I think that it's misguided sometimes. That gentleman would probably be better off looking at ways in which to improve the African-American community, such as in education.
Well, Damien, I'm going to let you go right there because Kimon is somebody who works so strongly to actually improve the lives of everybody in his community, starting from the young people who show up at his station to intern, the 3- and 4-year-olds who show up for education and daycare and healthy food, to improving the neighborhood by painting murals over graffiti, to standing out there and protesting with all races for Black Lives Matter. And he is somebody who makes an honest difference in his community. And I just won't stand
no way,
for any
no
illness.
And there's no way he would have known that. But we'll just say that the one project that we had Kimon on about is by no means all of what Kimon is.
Right.
We've seen it, you know, he doesn't just walk the walk.
Yeah,
I mean, just
exactly.
Talk the talk. He walks the walk.
He is somebody I have the utmost respect for. And you can trash me all day long, but he's not here to defend himself. Although I'd welcome his comments.
That would have been interesting.
Yes. All right. Let's check in with Steve, listening on Sirius in Long Island, New York. Steve, thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman Program and for hanging out with us today.
Thank you. I'm just going to say I have two quick things. One is to answer Damien, who was just on, who lives literally 10 minutes from where I am now on Long Island. That is a bastion of conservatism, mostly law enforcement where he lives. So that's why he's coming from where he's coming from. And the fact that they haven't gotten over the fact that names don't hurt me, what I do proves who I am, doesn't matter to them for some strange reason.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing is to Joe. you know, Joe, I hate to say it, but I'm jumping on a Joe bandwagon like everybody else.
Poor Joe.
He mentioned how Obama expanded presidential power. Now, he's wrong. The president prior to him expanded presidential power.
Mm-hmm.
That was George Bush, the one that the Republicans would like to forget mm-hmm. was their president, who caused more havoc than any Democrat in the history of this country.
Yeah, I mean, Bush came up with the unitary executive.
Exactly.
You know, a phrase that we hadn't even considered before that president. Although, you know, then they'll say you always like to blame George Bush. Well, sometimes, you know, if the shoe fits.
Yeah.
Well, if the server. That and the fact that all the emails went through the RNC server instead of through the White House server, you know, and then that they go after Hillary for having her own server, which in hindsight now is more secure than the government server, considering that ISIS grabbed a whole bunch of pilot names and everything from the government's own website.
Yeah. Based on, you know, empirical evidence, the government has been hacked numerous times. As far as we know, Hillary Clinton has not. So you raise an excellent point there, Steve, and maybe the emails were better off. We certainly know that Republican presidential administrations don't have the greatest track record when it comes to preserving emails.
And also on the email thing, and maybe we'll just finish up with this, I think sure. it's something that has been out there a lot. And I've learned that, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong tomorrow, that when it comes to classified emails, there's a completely different system
right.
that everyone goes over. It has nothing to do with the State Department or anything else like that. So that when it comes to classified materials, totally different protocol. Wouldn't have even been on her server.
Yeah. So many great guests, great calls, even Joe today.
Poor Joe.
We appreciate all of them. And thanks for hanging out with us. It really is an honor that you spend your day with us. So we'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for watching, listening, hanging out with the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com, everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.